It's the 8th day of June. Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll put context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jeremy Maggs this afternoon. Here's what you can look forward to in the next 30 minutes. Business draws a line in the sand over Johannesburg's collapse. We also ask the question of why access to an HIV drug, which is said to be a game changer, is not enough, given that South Africa helped to develop it. From day zero to El Nino, we look at the next drought and how that could be much more worse than what is being predicted. And we end off with education, Oxford over Ivy League. A new trend is emerging among South Africa's top matriculants. Johannesburg, a world-class African city. The city of gold, or a city in decline. You take your pick. The metro is home to over 6 million people. That's about the size of Kuwait's entire population and is the country's financial capital. Jozi, or Joburg, is where a bulk of foreign and investment decisions are made, so a lot rides on getting it to work. The city's decline has captured the imagination of its residents and businesses alike as they bear the consequences. And as a result, the latter has issued a clear call: fix governance, and we will deploy appropriate private sector resources into a program of structured support for Johannesburg's recovery. Martin Kingston chairs Business for South Africa, or B4SA. He joins us now for more. More so, Martin, good afternoon to you. On the open letter that you wrote, addressed to all political parties, the president, the GNU partners, residents of Johannesburg, and businesses. And you say you're prepared to deploy appropriate private sector resources into a program of structured support for Johannesburg's recovery. What is this program of structured support?
Well, I think the starting point, Dudu, is that we need to accept the very significant problems and challenges that are now facing not only Johannesburg, but as a consequence, the country as a whole. Our efforts to make real and sustainable progress towards inclusive growth are undermined by what we see in terms of the degradation of the performance of the city of Johannesburg. As you've said, it is not only the hub, but the center of economic activity for South Africa, where many investment decisions are made by small, large, domestic and international investors. And confidence has eroded over the past several years, and it needs to be restored. What we've seen in the context of the existing government business partnership, where we focus today specifically on energy, and we've seen the reduction, in fact, effectively, the removal of load shedding, transport and logistics, where we've seen a fundamental improvement in the logistics network, and crime and corruption, where for the first time now, and I think that's being highlighted by the steps that are being taken, we are seeing a real turnaround in addressing the challenges in the criminal justice sector and crime and corruption, is that working together with and in support of the national agenda, business, the private sector has got a very significant role to play in a structured and thoughtful and very focused manner. And we are saying the same thing can and should happen in Johannesburg, but it can't happen without many of the fundamental ingredients for that partnership being in place, where we will be prepared to mobilize skills, expertise and resources in a focused and disciplined manner in certain of the areas. What we have furthermore said in our call for action, exactly as you've said, is that in the case of the current administration, there's immediate stabilization of the city's finances, that we see transparent reporting against clear delivery indicators, and that there's consequence management, an issue that doesn't just bedevil the city of Johannesburg, but more broadly in South Africa. So, in the context of the parties contesting the elections, we're actually asking for commitments as to how they're going to address the very challenges that we have referred to and re-establish governance. And from the president and national government, we're asking them to intervene with the powers that are available to support structural and financial reforms.
Because in your open letter, you rightfully diagnose the problem, some of which you have outlined right now. And you speak of a counterparty capable of governing scrupulously, delivering for the city and being held to account. And so this counterparty, once it is in place, you say business is prepared to work in partnership to develop a recovery program covering infrastructure, service delivery and fiscal stabilization. You rightfully mention also in your open letter that maintenance spending stands at 0.5% of asset value. So where infrastructure is concerned, do you have specific areas in the city of Johannesburg? You go to the CBD, for instance, and you can see that there hasn't been any maintenance in most parts, right, that has been done. So is there a plan in terms of which areas specifically you'll be gunning for?
Well, so we have said that we will sit with the administration once they meet the requirements. And by the way, these are, I think, conventional requirements. They're not controversial in any shape, size or form, but an administration that is prepared to accept responsibility and accountability and recognize what the key challenges are and how to deal with them. And then we can bring skills, resources and expertise to bear. I mean, it is clear, as you've said, Dudu, in the context, for example, of maintenance expenditure, that what we've seen happening, or indeed not happening in Johannesburg, is appalling. We've got a maintenance spending at about 0.5% of asset value. It's roughly 1/18 of the metro average in the country. You know, we've seen rates and service charges increasing by over 120% in real terms over the past 15 years, while service delivery has dramatically and visibly deteriorated. So whether it is in the context of city power, whether it is in the context of Johannesburg Water, whether it is in context of the fixed infrastructure such as the roads, I think each and every one of those are areas where we've got skills and capabilities to bring to bear. But it needs to be under the right governance structure, as I said, with an appropriate approach being mobilized and adopted, not only by the city authorities, but backed by provincial and national governments to ensure that the performance is not only monitored, but that a lack of performance results in consequences, and equally that the private sector, which is what has happened at a national level, stays within its lane, but is the most significant both contributor to the economy of the city and one of the most significant beneficiaries, as a consequence of which it can drive inclusive economic growth, not just in Johannesburg, but nationwide, that we co-opt the involvement of the private sector, again, in a transparent and an accountable manner.
What will satisfy business when you speak of transparency, accountability? You speak of reporting measures, right? So tracking the finances and being absolutely clear and also open about the finances, because you speak of the situation in Johannesburg not being due to a lack of financial resources, but corruption, criminality and maladministration. They appear to be increasingly entrenched within elements of the city. The Auditor General estimates annual losses of approximately 12 billion rand through unauthorized and irregular expenditure. You touched on what is happening with the Matlanga Commission, for instance, right now, and what we're seeing, that you appear once and you will be prosecuted. A welcome move. So what are we saying will satisfy you here? Are you looking for maybe a commission? Because it is one thing to have commitments on paper. It is another thing to actually do it, right? So what will satisfy you that this issue of corruption, criminality and maladministration, which is deeply entrenched in the city of Johannesburg, will go some way in being eradicated?
Yeah, well, so I think that, you know, many people have talked about the possibility of a commission, and that might well be a good idea, but for the fact that we don't have the time as a country or as a city to wait for the outcome of those commissions. That would be an appropriate way of looking at the hygiene, whether it is there or not, and what consequences should flow. In the interim, it is clear that actually what is required is a city administration that steps up the plate and acknowledges both the challenges that confront the city, the problems that exist and how they're going to be remediated, the role and responsibility of the parties concerned, both within the city administration and where there is scope for the private sector to be involved, clarity about consequence management, a commitment to exactly the areas that you've talked about, which in most countries and most cities, as you said, this is a city that is the size of some countries in terms of the scale of its both its economy and its population, that they conduct themselves appropriately. And that has to be, by the way, Dudu, backed, as I said, by the provincial government and by the national government at the level of the government of national unity. We can't have a situation where we've got, if you like, anarchic behavior within one aspect of the political environment responsible for governing and administering the city, when actually there is no ability to force outcomes and hold people to account. And I think that unless and until such time as we have that, and there is an explicit acknowledgement, whether it be by the existing administration and the current political parties that form the coalition, or a future administration, business is not going to be prepared to get involved in a coordinated way. I should just add, business is already involved in a whole host of initiatives throughout the city. It's fragmented. It is impactful in, if you like, in a focused manner, but it doesn't have the scale and the leverage that is required to address this problem currently for a city that accounts for, as you said, some 16% of the GDP for the country.
Martin, thank you very much for your contribution this afternoon. Martin Kingston is chair of B4SA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Lenacapavir, an injectable HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP drug that was researched in the Global South, has been launched in South Africa. Concerns linger, though, about the country's rollout plan, which is criticized for being unambitious, low-scale, and in danger of being more about the pomp than the public health impact. Tian Johnson is a strategist and founder of African Alliance. He joins us now to outline some of their concerns. Thank you very much, Tian, for your time. So this drug, maybe let's start with that. It's been described as a game changer in HIV prevention. For some of our listeners who may not be familiar with it, what makes it so significant and how could it change the course of South Africa's HIV epidemic?
Thanks for having us. You know, lenacapavir is arguably the most important HIV prevention breakthrough since PrEP. Instead of taking a pill every day, you receive an injection just twice a year. And that matters because adherence has always been one of the biggest challenges in our country. You know, daily pills require us to remember each day. Sometimes it requires us to disclose our status. We have to navigate stigma and to stay connected, you know, to clinics and healthcare providers. This injection removes many of those barriers. And so the excitement around lenacapavir is absolutely justified. You know, the trials showed extraordinarily high levels of protection, and we know that if we can get this to the people who need it, it could be a real game changer.
One of your concerns is the scale of the rollout. You perceive that it's not nearly enough. Why do you believe the current targets fall so far short of what is needed? And maybe you can talk to the need versus the response.
For sure. I mean, I think we have to measure any level of success against the epidemic, you know, not against the number of doses that are made available or, you know, some glamorous kind of launch event that's a once-off, you know, with selfies with the president. That's all great. But I think the reality is we have the largest HIV epidemic in the world. And the modeling shows that around 2 million people need access to lenacapavir if we are serious about reducing transmission. So against that backdrop, you know, this tiny shipment of 40,000 is not even a fraction. So what worries us is that the scarcity is kind of being normalized. So instead of asking, you know, how quickly can we get to the millions of people who need it today, we're currently debating about how to distribute a really, you know, limited supply. And that's a huge concern, because what we need to do is we need to be honest about the scale gap. It's an important milestone. It's not yet an epidemic changing intervention that many of the headlines suggest.
How should we understand the scale gap then? What is that due to? And what can the president and the health minister do differently right now?
I mean, I think the first thing we need to do is we just need to be honest. You know, of course, it's fair and fine having the, you know, like you said, the pomp and the ceremony. But the reality is that as South Africans who took part in the science, who made this product possible, we are not seeing the actual levels of access. We're still seeing a pharmaceutical company who is having a spectacular amount of power in terms of how we respond to our HIV prevention. So in terms of the gap, we need to understand that government should be using every policy and legal tool to increase supply and accelerate that access. So what does that mean? That means that Gilead, the pharmaceutical company, the manufacturer, needs to come to the table more meaningfully. And that means talking about opening access. It means about allowing local manufacturers to get on with the important work of manufacturing. Right now, even if we had the money, we couldn't purchase it. So the supply is being constrained mostly by a pharmaceutical company. So first is looking at how we begin to benchmark, how we can move towards the levels of coverage that we need. And that means access to millions and not thousands. And to get there, a few things must happen, right? First, supply must increase dramatically. Local manufacturing has to become a reality and not just a promise. Government has to treat access as a political priority instead of a technical program. But the real message here is that, or the real question is that, whether South Africa really wants to manage HIV or end HIV. If we're serious about ending HIV, then lenacapavir has to be scaled at a level that matches the epidemic itself. We should not be rolling it out as a small pilot.
There's a contradiction here, because South African researchers, trial participants and clinics helped generate the evidence that made lenacapavir possible. And so as we went into this, what was the understanding then? Why do we find ourselves in this situation? Did we not clear out from the beginning the workings and the fundamental workings in terms of the rollout before we got here?
I mean, this is something advocates have been calling on for decades, really. Mm. And what we've always been saying is that, you know, no matter how bold your science is, no matter how bold the endeavor is, if our scientists, our researchers, our regulators, our national governments, our national research bodies are not standing up with courage before they do a trial and saying, if I'm going to begin research into a potentially life-saving treatment, you as the drug manufacturer who's supporting this clinical research, what is your commitment to public access? What is your commitment to making sure that should this become a life-saving product, should the clinical trials go the way we want them to, what is your position? We've learned this time and time again. There's absolutely no reason why we should be here. We saw the exact same thing in COVID. African communities making vaccines mm-hmm. possible, but watching their television screens and seeing people overseas and those who have money access to vaccines before we could, after wave and wave of death. So we knew better. We are simply not doing better. And so this is an indictment on our scientists, our researchers, our research bodies, and more importantly, our leadership, our so-called leadership, to come to the party and understand that we have to move away from the celebratory headlines and ask the bottom line: how many lives are we saving? How many infections are we averting every single year? And that is the crux of it for us. So the question is not just, you know, why we're not buying more. The question is, why have we accepted a situation where we cannot buy even if we had the money? You know, we've accepted a model where a company headquartered thousands of kilometers away is determining how many South Africans can access this epidemic-changing tool. The real issue is not procurement. It's about power.
Thank you very much, Tian, for your contribution this afternoon. Tian Johnson is strategist and founder of African Alliance.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
From persistent rains to potential hot and dry weather conditions, El Niño has been on almost everybody's lips. The phenomenon is expected to pronounce itself in the 2026-27 summer season in South Africa. Alarm bells are being rung about drought, water security and agricultural resilience as a result. Karen King is Climate Resilience Director at ATANA and is standing by to speak to us, Karen, about South Africa's preparedness for a potential El Niño-driven drought. We've been here before, most recently 2023-2024. How did we fare then in assessing our preparedness today? Good day to you.
Hi, thank you very much. Yeah, so the South African Weather Service is warning of a very likely return to El Niño conditions and a possible, what they're calling, a super El Niño. So in respect of whether we'll experience severe drought as a result, El Niño it's quite predictable at a macro level. So we should definitely heed the warning of a return to El Nino conditions lasting through at least the end of next summer. Having said that, El Nino drought conditions in South Africa occur when trade winds weaken or they significantly weaken in the case of a super El Nino, which is a natural process. And when the surface water in the Pacific Ocean warms or warms significantly in the case of a super El Nino, which is a human-induced change. So this is clearly a very large-scale global phenomenon. So its intensity and its localized damage impacts are still highly variable and very difficult to predict. But while we can't predict exactly which areas will be affected and when, we definitely should be better prepared for all coming drought conditions. Drought is often the climate risk we underestimate. Because drought unfolds gradually, we often respond to it too late. We feel as if we have time to adapt. And unlike something like flooding, drought's slow onset period creates this false sense of security. Its impacts, however, are every bit as destructive, and they accumulate over time through water shortages, through declining agricultural production, through rising food prices and pressures on local economies. So we're underprepared and we really need to take this seriously.
Sure, underprepared. So we didn't learn our lessons from the most recent one that we just went through. What does drought resilience look like then in practice?
Yeah, so it depends on where in the country one is, but we are largely no better prepared for droughts than we ever were, and in some cases less so. So some of the country's major cities could face another day zero type scenario. And while Johannesburg is not facing a citywide formal day zero at the moment, communities across large parts of the metro are already experiencing localized day zero-like conditions. The lessons we could take or should take from the previous day zero warnings include things like decentralizing and diversifying water supplies before the crisis hits, actively involving citizens in resource conservation, and building financial resilience for public utilities. The major lessons we should take from the more recent 2023-2024 regional drought include shifting early from reactive crisis management to proactive resilience, crop diversification to tolerate heat and drought, and then upgrading and maintaining municipal water infrastructure, which we hear so much about, in order to curb losses and to strengthen regional food security safety nets is another important one.
Earlier, you spoke about how the Super El Nino is a human-induced change. I hope I heard you correctly there. Please correct me if I did not. And so what does this speak to, one, about us, communities, municipalities, businesses? What can we do?
So it's a combination. So the trade winds are a natural phenomenon, but the extra warming of the Pacific Ocean is more a human-induced change. So what we need to do is we need to adopt preparedness as something that's practical, not theoretical. We need to focus on water security, food security, and infrastructure resilience simultaneously. Practical applications need to include things like maintaining and upgrading water infrastructure, reducing water losses, protecting our groundwater resources, so using it but only when we've calculated and can use the yield from the borehole that is sustainable, expanding and decentralizing our water storage and our reuse, strengthening local planning and response capacity, and then supporting climate-resilient agriculture, so choosing crops wisely. So, for example, South Africa needs to diversify its staple crop use. We are very reliant on maize, while things like millet and sorghum are more drought-resistant, more pest-resistant, and they have a higher food value than the highly refined maize we all eat so much of. And then at a more individual and community level, drought resilience will probably mean storing water in things like water tanks, reusing grey water at home, and then keeping a small amount of unscented, unopened bleach that's less than a year old in all houses. You only need 2 to 4 drops of bleach per liter of water to disinfect it. And bleach is a good alternative. It's inexpensive and it's widely available.
Why is investing in preparedness significantly more cost effective than disaster response itself?
Well, every drought creates significant economic, social and infrastructure costs. And preparedness is not only one of the most effective tools against climate change, it is one of the most cost-effective resilience investments a country can make. The cost of preparedness is always significantly lower than the cost of a crisis. Local studies have found that for every rand invested in climate resilience, we save between 3 and 7 rand in avoided damages, in emergency cleanup, in relief, and in long-term economic impacts. And it's not just us finding this. In Australia, studies have found that this ratio could be about 1 to 10, and in America, about 1 to 12. And these are countries that share our history of really severe drought conditions.
Karen King is Climate Resilience Director at Atana. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
For decades, South Africa's most ambitious matriculants had one well-worn path when looking to study abroad, and that was the United States. Names like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton became the ultimate default for local academic elites. The trend is fundamentally shifting, and the talent pipeline is moving to the United Kingdom. So what is informing this trend, you may ask? Well, Crimson Education's country manager, Brad Latila Campbell, is standing by to answer that particular question for us. Brad, why the shift to the UK? Good afternoon.
Hi, Dudu. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I think we're not necessarily seeing a full shift away from the US, but we are definitely seeing more and more of our top academic achievers from South African high schools, both across kind of the private system of the IEB or the public system of the NSC, are looking at the UK more and more as an option.
Now, the students making these moves, they represent our future specialized talent pool. From a business perspective, what does it mean for the country if our brightest minds are leaving into the UK, whether it's the UK or the US, in terms of higher education?
Yeah, look, there's always obviously the risk of students going abroad that you lose some of that talent pool. But there is also the really great potential benefit that students are going to go abroad, pick up new experiences, learn from new and different systems that we don't necessarily have available here, and then return to South Africa with that different knowledge, right? So it is a lot about diversifying the knowledge and talent pool that we have in South Africa by providing some of this kind of extra or different education into the pool.
That's very encouraging that they come back and they, yes, you know, pour those skills back into the country. In terms of competition, it's quite rife in terms of spots at institutions like these. What does a South African matriculant need on their profile today to actually secure a spot?
Yeah, look, so the UK is more similar to South Africa than the US, right? Where they will first and foremost take into account your academic marks, the actual grades you're getting in your different subjects and the subjects that you're taking. So if you want to study engineering, for instance, you need to make sure that you've got physics or whatever subjects those universities require. So if you're looking to get into one of these top UK schools that we know, like Exeter or Warwick or Durham, you need to make sure that your academics, your actual grades, are in tip-top shape, right? So it's different to South Africa, where you need to get a kind of a minimum point score, and then you are almost guaranteed a selection in most courses, or a guaranteed admission. In the UK, some of these courses are competitive, which means that there are more eligible students than there are places. And so the universities will only take the amount of spaces that they have, which means maybe you're only getting the top 30 or 40% at some of these schools. Mm-hmm. So you need to make sure that not only are you meeting the minimum requirements, you're also making sure that you're in that top 30 or 40%. And on top of that, they might want to see engagement with what that specialized education might mean. So if you're looking to study law, have you engaged with that beyond what that might mean as an academic subject? So have you done internships at a law firm, or looked at actually what the career in law might look like for you, and so on and so forth, through all the different options that you might have to study.
Interesting. So as a parent, you obviously have a big say in what happens here, because you're going to have to deal with, for instance, visa complexities, if there are any. Maybe you can speak to the two countries and how it works when we're comparing maybe the US as opposed to the UK. What as a parent you will be faced with when it comes to visas. You obviously want to make sure that your child is on a campus that is safe. You want to understand the politics of that campus, etc. So talk to us about some of the decisions that the parents have to make and navigating those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously the biggest decision around where to send your child to university is obviously cost. And coming from South Africa, I think that studying overseas and studying abroad in general represents a big financial commitment. And that has its own complexities around what the US and the UK and Europe has to offer. But in terms of actually going, I think that we've seen by and large out of South Africa a willingness to admit South African students en masse. Most students, if not all students that we've worked with have gained admission and gotten their visas. So it's a good it is a good option and an available option for most students. Even in the US, where we see a lot of kind of pushback on immigrants, there isn't actually a big impact on South African in particular students. We have seen that in the rest of Africa, places like Zimbabwe and Tanzania, but in South Africa in particular, it's not really a prevalent issue in either the US or the UK in terms of getting that visa so you can go and study overseas.
You mentioned some other countries on the continent. That's quite interesting. Are we seeing, or have you seen parents choose to send their kids to the rest of the continent, or are we looking more abroad, outside of the continent?
No, no. So we're definitely from South Africa seeing students go abroad, to mainly to, you know, the US, the UK and Europe more in general, and Europe as well. So we're seeing a kind of a big surge towards that over the last few years. And the UK has developed as an option, as you were saying. They didn't always accept a local curriculum, right? So the IEB or the NSC. But in 2008, 2009, the IEB got the curricula ratified and certified and rated, and so those UK universities started to accept it, and so those universities were now opened up to South African students, and so they could apply there. And so as there's been more and more opportunity and more places for South Africans to look and go, we've seen more and more South African students consider it and take it into account when choosing where to do their tertiary education.
Okay, for a parent who's listening to this and saying, I just need maybe to hear a case study of a child or children who have gone abroad and they were fine, you know, I just maybe need a case study to convince me. Maybe you can share some stories, right, of kids who've left the country and are thriving. What do they say about us South Africans? We're what, a resilient bunch?
Yes, absolutely. and well known for being, you know, gregarious and loud as well, I think is another aspect that we're well known for. But we've seen many, many students go abroad and thrive. I mean, I myself studied in the US and had a fantastic time there, really, really enjoyed my time there. But we've seen students that, in fact, if any of our listeners are interested, they can contact us for a further kind of deep dive into this. But a student from St. Stithians who's going to be going across now, in August to the UK, who's going to go do biomedical engineering. And we've seen students also go across for kind of a range of slightly more niche degrees than you might expect to find in South Africa, things like aerospace or aeronautical engineering, biomedical related subjects as well, at places like Exeter, Warwick, Durham, and students from kind of all over the country as well, who are really thriving and enjoying their time there, as well as in the US and Europe. And we've got a student Tendo who's gone to study medicine in Europe as well, which has been a really great experience for her. And we've got a couple of report backs from her. If people are interested in seeing those and listening to those, we've got some webinars that we've done with these students who've not only started their careers there, but then have, you know, talked to us about what it's like and what it's been like to study there and how they're enjoying it and what life is like in general.
Thank you so much, Brad. Crimson Education's country manager, Brad Latila Campbell. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Jeremy Maggs is back with you tomorrow afternoon. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, bahaichu, bulekio.